I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, PBS television chef Lidia Bastianich. When the Istrian Peninsula was annexed by Yugoslavia after World War II, families who were ethnically Italian had a new identity imposed upon them, seemingly overnight. They had to live as communists and speak Croatian. That was the reality for Lidia Bastianich as a young girl, until her family escaped to Italy, spending 2 years in a refugee camp before coming to America. It's a journey that's hard to fathom, and the constants sustained Bastianich along the way were family and food. We'll talk to her about hours spent in her grandmother's garden and kitchen, her first job in a New York bakery, and the culinary empire she built from the ground up. Our conversation starts after a short break. Most people probably know Lidia Bastianich from her PBS cooking shows and from her culinary empire in New York, including the critically acclaimed restaurant Validia and the wildly popular food and wine marketplace Eataly. Before her career as a renowned chef, Lidia Bastianich lived a very different life. After the communist takeover of the Istrian Peninsula along the Adriatic Sea, Lidia and her family fled to Italy, living in a refugee camp for more than 2 years before coming to America with little more than a few suitcases. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. At the age of 11, Lidia started over with her family in New York. They watched every penny and worked diligently to find jobs and learn English, hoping to carve out a safe and secure life in the United States. But it was hard to leave Istria behind. All the memories of cooking with her grandmother and picking ripe fruit from the garden. It's that strong connection to cooking and the people who taught her how that inspired Bastianich to write her memoir, My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. Lidia, welcome to Think.
Buongiorno, Courtney.
So glad to have you here. Now, before we talk food and explore your journey from Istria to America, let's talk about your name. You weren't always Lidia, were you?
No, I was not. I was Giuliana. And actually, my mother and my brother still call me Giuliana. And the fact was that, you know, communism didn't allow you to practice your religion, and we were Catholics. And I was baptized secretly, if you will, and my aunt, my mother's sister, whose name is Lidia, was in charge of kind of sneaking me in the church and baptizing me, and she was my sort of santola, as we call it. And my mother had asked her to put the name Giuliana, which was kind of the name of the people of that area, Giuliani. The area, when it was Italy, was known Friuli, Venezia, Giulia, the Giulia part. Mm-hmm. And my aunt went, and on the baptism paper, she put Lidia first, Giuliana second.
Just but on
she,
a whim?
Just, no, she wanted her name first. And but she didn't tell my mother or anybody. So I came home. I was Giuliana, like my mother had instructed her to do. And until I went to school and my mother had to pull out the papers, and they realized that my real name was really Lidia, then Giuliana, I kind of switched to Lidia. But for the first 6-7 years of my life, I was Giuliana.
Does anyone still call you
Lidia,
Giuliana?
Does
anyone still call you Giuliana?
Absolutely.
That's wonderful. So yeah. You answer to both.
I do. My mother, my brother, the family still calls me Giuliana.
So I know your aunt snuck you out of the hospital for your kind of secret baptism because religious practice was very restricted under communist rule. You obviously were very young. Your brother was very young when Tito took power and things changed kind of seemingly overnight in Istria. But from what you understand and what you know, how did daily life really change for families who were living in Istria once communism was imposed?
I think they, you know, from what I heard, and there was a lot of whispering going on because, you know, they followed you. They really put the communist dogma down. In our family, there was land taken away. They only left enough land that you can support your family, and everything became communal farms. My father he's a mechanic. He had two little trucks, and that was his business, and we lived quite well from all of the... And they took away. They deemed him a capitalist. They took away the trucks, and they put him in jail for a while, and they let him out. So it was really restrictive. You couldn't practice the religion. You couldn't talk Italian. And you had to work within the boundaries of the communist communal, if you will, whether it were farms or factories or whatever. As a child, you know, 7, 8, 9, you life is beautiful in a sense that my mother was, she was a school teacher, an elementary school teacher. And of course, she was Italian in teaching. But, you know, when you live in a border situation, you speak the languages that are surround that border, whether it's a little German, a little Croatian or Yugoslavian this time. So she had to really relearn and pick the Yugoslavian, forget about the Italian. So it was difficult within the family. You can see that there was kind of a secretive underground movement, you know, how people were one in their homes and another one when they were outside.
A place you speak about with incredible tenderness throughout the book is your grandmother's home. Describe it a little bit for us.
Well, maybe because that was my refuge. My mother put myself and my brother in this little town where grandma lived outside of the big town, Pula, so that we couldn't be observed. With grandma, you know, older people were not as followed. And grandma was the one that food was scarce at that time, and she felt she needed to make, grow, raise food for the whole family, not just mine, the whole family. And it was such a beautiful and idyllic place. It was pastoral. We had chickens, we had ducks, we had rabbits, we had goats. You know, I would milk the goats in the morning for breakfast. We had pigs every November. We had the slaughter. We made prosciutto, we made sausages. Grandpa made olive oil, he made wine, and of course the garden, the seasonality of the garden. You know, she would send me out, go pick up the peas, the fresh peas, the fresh favas. And I knew, you know, as little as I was, you know, you pick the big pods that had the big peas in there, and then you shell them, and I ate some of them. And I used to even go and collect the potatoes with her from the ground, you know, when they were ripe in June, July. And I had my own little basket, and she would go first, take the big potatoes, you know, pluck up the plant. And I had, I was behind collecting the little potatoes, still nice and warm in my hand.
And is that really where kind of you fell in love with food and cooking and all those, the rituals that go with them?
I think that that's the reference library, my food reference library of flavors was kind of accumulated, was built in those really pristine, delicious, natural flavors, but also the memory. Because once my parents in 1956 decided, I was 9 years old, that, you know, they needed to get away. They needed to bring us to a better place to raise us. And hence it meant getting away from Yugoslavia. My mother, my brother and I were allowed to go and visit relatives that we had on the other side. My father was not given the visa, so he had to escape. And 2 weeks later, he escaped over the border. They ran after him. They were shooting at him, but he made it. And then we met all in Trieste, Italy, and we kind of began our track. But I didn't know that I was not going to go back, and until my father came, because I thought we were going to go visit the aunt and then we're going to come back. And so I had unfinished business. I didn't say goodbye to grandma. I didn't say goodbye to my friends. And I think that that's where my food really connection became so intense, because from then on, I missed all that setting and grandma so much. That food kind of was my connector. The smells, the cooking of it, that reminded me of grandma, reminded me of that idyllic place. And I guess I loved food from then on.
So as you all decided to go to Italy, it was a different travel experience for you, your mother, and your brother than your father, because he was not issued a visa. They were skeptical of why he would be going.
Sure.
So talk about how you got there and what happened when you arrived.
Well, when we arrived the first time, the three of us, of course, we had the family and the aunt, and it was kind of, you know, for my brother and I, it was a big city, a city that kind of offered many more experiences. I mean, we had things we never had, great oranges and chocolates and all of that. And under communism, those were rare things. So for us, it was kind of a party first, in a sense. And then my father came and everything changed, because the reality kind of what they really had planned had to be implemented. And so he didn't have any papers.
And he walked there, right?
He walked. From the border, he walked about 30 kilometers to get over the border to ultimately get into the city and to come to find us. And I remember when he came at 2 o'clock in the morning, he was kind of scratched and he was full of mud and he just collapsed in front of the door. And then sort of, you know, you kind of realize that something is happening that's different. But not having any papers, our visa were to expire. He didn't have any paper. We could have been repatriated. So my parents decided legally to go to the police and say, we do not want to go back to communism. We ask for asylum. Now, we could have been Italian because we were originally Italian, but my parents felt that even Italy after the war was a little difficult and the papers were there because we would have to redo papers. So there was an option where the police put us in a political refugee camp. Mm-hmm. It was called San Saba. Now it's a museum and it's in Trieste. And we stayed there for 2 years awaiting a chance to migrate someplace.
And that was a long 2 years. And tell us a little bit about that experience. It was not maybe what some people imagine. You weren't, you know, in a tent and starving, but it was a very stark existence. Tell us a little bit what that was like.
Well, the buildings themselves and the area themselves was a Nazi concentration camp before. I only found that out later. And so it was this kind of closed in setting with a big courtyard with this big this building, these brick buildings, and on each floor there were makeshifts, little kind of bedrooms for families, and we all on this big loft had little cubicles, and the families all lived. You heard everything. The separation was maybe sometimes some cloth or some cardboards or whatever. We had a communal bathroom and a tub. And underneath there was the first ground floor was the mensa, where we would eat. And we would all get on line with our little plates, just like you see, to await for our food. And the food was good. I don't remember being hungry, but I remember being very frightened as a young child. All these different people from different nationalities, because all of Eastern Europe was coming into the Western Europe, escaping communism. And it's not that it was a friendly place. And I know that we huddled always together as the family. And I was so afraid that they separated at some point. My mother and myself from my brother and my father, the male from the female. And I remember that moment that night, because we waited a whole night. It was like a quarantine and they'd separated them. But I didn't know. I thought that I would never see my father. So there were moments of intense kind of fright and wondering what will happen next.
And I remember it stuck with me. You said that you always felt cold there, no matter what the season. There was just a chill that stuck to San Saba.
There was the big courtyard, and they had this big kind of sinks where people would wash themselves in the morning, or they can wash their clothes and whatever. And the courtyard was partly cemented, partly rocks, and it was always kind of muddy. I guess the sun never got to it. Or was it in my mind? I'm not sure. But it was an awfully cold place.
So a lot of desolation and fear and just really not knowing how long you were going to be there.
Exactly. This kind of insecurity of, you know, when are we going to have our own home? When are we going to be together as a family? When are we going to be free to walk? All of this, you know, you think as a child. And not necessarily do you always want to torment your parents, because you could see that they were worried themselves. So I know that my brother and I would huddle a lot of time and we would talk to each other and ask, you know, what do you think? But, you know, you become also very considerate of your parents. And, you know, as a child, you want them to feel good and you don't want your action to make them feel worse.
Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. Our guest this hour is Lidia Bastianich. Her book is called My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. We'll be back in just a minute. Listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. Our guest this hour is Lidia Bastianich, who's a TV chef and owns many successful restaurants. Her new memoir is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. So Lidia, when we left before the break, we were talking about life in an Italian refugee camp called San Saba, where you and your family spent more than 2 years. And then you finally got word that the American borders had been open and you could go interview at the consulate for a chance to emigrate to America. So what happened next?
Well, actually, it was Dwight Eisenhower that was the president, and he opened the immigration for the visas for people fleeing communism. And at that point, we were one of the first families that they began to interview. We had nobody here. So the Catholic Relief Services, the Catholic Charities, and the Red Cross were very instrumental. They actually brought us here. They paid for the trip. And they took care of us when we ultimately came here. The whole trip, the whole process of vetting and all of that happened in Italy. But then we came here, and I remember they came to pick us up at the now JFK Airport, and then they took us in these yellow buses, which I guess were school buses, to Manhattan in a hotel. And they put us there, and we were about 30 families, different ethnic families that were, and they put us there, and we went to speak to the social service person who spoke Italian, and she gave my mother a certain amount of money to feed us until they would look and find a home for us, a job for them, and so on. So, it in retrospect, now when I think about it, then as a child, you kind of took maybe even things for granted. I know my brother and I, we were so excited to come to America. Finally, the freedom, all those things, all those worries. This is where we're going to have a home. This is where we're going to, I'm going to put my roots. This is where I'm going to live forever. And it was, but then also just in the middle of Manhattan, everything about America that we had seen somewhat on television, everything was true. There was so much. And I remember the two of us were extremely excited. And if we were there for about three weeks, and then ultimately they found a little home for us in New Jersey, a job for my father, and we began our life. But Courtney, when I think about it now, that little house, people that we didn't know came and filled the house with the beds, with the chairs, with the table. They filled our cupboards with food, people that gave of themselves to kind of help this family. They had no connections to us, just the goodness of their heart. And you just, you can't, those things just, as you go on in life and you see and you achieve and you're given certain opportunities, you look back and you say, oh my God, those people were really, there are so many good people out there. And in a sense, quite a few years in my life, I have this great sense of gratitude, and how am I going to help, and how am I going to go give back? And I guess my memoir is one way of sharing those sentiments.
One thing I loved in the book, and this came up several times, is your mom was never very comfortable with how much charity had been given to your family. Share with our listeners how she constantly tried to make things right there.
Oh my God. So they gave us, I don't remember, the first for the first week, $16 or $18. Now this is in 1958, so it went a while. But that first week, we found a little deli and they spoke Italian. And we, our meal for that whole week was Wonder Bread, milk, and bananas. She thought that that would be a balanced meal and she wouldn't spend the money. And so when we came the next week to the social worker and the social worker asked us, how did you feel? Did you eat? Did you, how much did you spend? She was so proud to show that she didn't spend much. And the social worker says, no, you got it wrong. You have to feed these children. She says, but I don't have a job. I have to return this money to you. This is not my money. And she continued on that. She just couldn't, wasn't at peace until she finally had a job. And do you know that after it was about 4 or 5 years, we went back to see, you know, we would go periodically. Say she was ready with her bank book to return, I don't know, it was maybe about $2,000-$3,000 to return to them the money that they gave.
And they would not take it back.
No. Says, you know, America welcomes you. You just begin your life and be a good American.
So I want to skip forward a little bit in time to play a clip from your cooking show. So you feature your own family members quite a bit on TV. And so here's a bit of you and someone that you call Grandma talking about an Italian proverb.
Grandma, while you eat, I'll tell you un proverbio. I guess you know the proverbio because you know a lot of Italian proverbs.
Mm-hmm.
Due dita di vino e un calcio al medico.
Al medico. You are brava, brava.
You know that
means. Very good.
An apple a day keeps the doctor away. But the Italians are a bit more straightforward about. Due dita di vino, 2 fingers of wine, sort of gives a kick to the doctor. So it kind of sends the doctor away.
So Grandma is your mom in this circumstance. And it seems like it's really important to you to bring her and her wisdom into everything you do.
Well, because she is so much part, you know. As a family, the Italians are always clinged together, and the hard times and the communism and Grandma and all of that. And then our trek as immigrants, we were alone. And really the importance of us being together, clinging together, it's what held us. It gave us the strength. And once we began our life in America, the freedom, you know, of achieving, of working, she was there. She was there to help me with my children. She was there to help me with my projects. She was always part of the success. She's 97 now. She lives with me. And we kind of take care of her now. She's still very lucid. And we enjoy her. And so she's part of the show. I can't, but, you know, my family is part of who I am. My family is who I am and what I achieved. It's all about everybody together. So we're still, I think, for me, that's, you know, just a given that without family, you know, a little food on a table and your family and you have everything.
It seems like children and adults have a very different experience starting over in a new country. What were some of the differences for you and your brother versus your parents in those early years in New York?
Well, none of us spoke English. So coming into a new country and trying to communicate, us children within the first year began to kind of talk and communicate. And, you know, we just kind of couldn't fast enough insert ourselves with our friends in, you know, we just wanted to be part of America. You know, it was, I remember Bobby socks and, you know, that kind of circular skirts. With
Poodle skirts
with the belt and Elvis Presley and all of that. So I couldn't wait. On the other hand, my mother and my father had a harder time, I think, too, especially my father. He remained nostalgic for most of the time, actually, I remember. And learning of English was a bit more difficult. My mother got into it and whatever. So, yes, I think that, you know, the older you are, the harder it is. You know, it's a grown tree. You can't bend it. A young tree, you can bend.
So immigration and the plight of the refugee family are topics at, you know, the very center of political debate today here in America, all over the world. What do you think of the immigrant experience today? Do you feel like it's much different from what you went through in the late 50s?
Well, I can't help but make comparisons and the parallels. It was different. But being a refugee, being without a home, and being not speaking the language, not the unknown is the most terrible feeling, especially for a child. You just don't know, and it just frightens you so. And I think that that still is the feeling when I see those children, when I see those human beings. I certainly don't know what their political situation is, but I can only hope that, you know, me telling my story has a very positive ending. And what I hope to communicate with that is that there is an option, that there is a possibility if somebody's given a chance to develop and to go ahead and to really make a dream out of their life or out of their opportunity.
So once you and your family moved to Astoria after your time in New Jersey, you really got a lot of hands-on kind of cooking experience. Then your cooking became part of your family's routine. Tell me a little bit about after school, what you would get going, and how kind of your responsibilities increased as you got more skilled in the kitchen.
Well, my mother became a seamstress because she couldn't be a teacher. She didn't speak the language. And she worked overtime, you know, tried to make money. And I was kind of in charge of preparing the dinner for the meal, for the dinner. And we would do it the night before. She would put, you know, she would soak the beans, or she would say, and then she would leave me the note, put so much water, put it to boil, add this, add that. And I would, you know, at the end of the day, I would cook the dinner, and then she would come home and maybe finish it, but I would, the pleasure. And one of the things that I discovered and was really, I loved was, the cakes in the box. And every night we had a dessert. I opened a box, I put some eggs or butter, whatever it needed, and I found it so, because I remember with grandma, you know, kneading, making desserts and making that. That took a long time, and I said, oh my God. So it made me feel really good. But again, food, I always reverted to food as a connection to my roots, to remembering my grandmother. And now food became a way of me giving to my family, helping the family to sort of forge ahead in our new settings. I guess ultimately it took me into the position that I am today.
And you said in the book that while at the beginning there were a lot of instructions and you kind of just followed your mother's routine to the letter, as you got older, she really let you kind of take charge of the menu. You got to be the creative director in the kitchen too.
Oh, absolutely. Then once I felt my comfort in the kitchen, she would let me know. And, you know, not always was it a success, but it made me feel good and encouraged me. And then as going on to school, I began, you know, looking for a side job and I went to work in a bakery, Walken's Bakery, Christopher Walken, actually. We're still friends.
This is Dad's bakery, Christopher Walken's dad?
Yeah, Walken's Bakery. There were three boys. Christopher was one of them. And I worked on weekends as a sales girl, you know, to supplement a little bit, to make a little extra money. And then when I went to college in the city, you know, working in restaurants like everybody does with a waiter or waitress, I usually worked in Italian restaurants, of course, because ended up in the kitchen a lot of times cooking rather than just waiting. And, what took me to the business, I think, ultimately, was meeting my husband, who was in the restaurant business, who was an immigrant from Istria, just like we were. And he wanted to open a restaurant. And I said, I'll do it with you.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. So tell me how you met your husband, that first meeting, and how you started working together.
Well, you know, there was refugees are kind of clannish, especially the older the parents and whatever. And so we in Astoria, Queens, we had encountered other refugees from the same area, and weekend gatherings, you know, in the cellar, actually, of the houses of the refugees that had come before us. And there I met my husband, Felice. He was a young man, a refugee. And we just, developed a relationship. And I think, you know, he would take me out to dinners, beautiful dinners, Romeo Salta and whatever. And, you know, and he, I guess that was my soft spot, food. And that's how we developed and eventually married.
And your mom was not thrilled initially at the relationship, right? She had plans for you.
Yes, actually, because it was before I was a sophomore in college. And so she was afraid that I would not finish college and whatever. But sometimes love overtakes. And it took me in this direction.
So at what point did you know, okay, I'm a newlywed, I'm happy. And when did you and Felice figure out, we're going to go into business, we're going to make a go of this?
Well, we had Joe by then, my first son, and it was 1971. And Felice, my husband, had already began planning with one of his co-workers. They were going to do a restaurant. And then that didn't work out. And I said to him, well, you know, I'll help you. You do what you feel like doing and I'll help you. It was a small restaurant, 9 tables. Mm-hmm. And we opened it, you know, with the help of my mother, with everybody. And I was certainly not a chef. We hired a chef. And after a month or so, I went in the kitchen and became the sous chef. I said, I have to get my hands in there. Right. I have to really learn how to manage a commercial kitchen. And for 10 years, I was his sous chef. By then, we had 2 restaurants, so we were busy. We were doing well. We sold those, and we opened Philidia on East 58th Street. And there, I became the chef. And what I did there that was maybe different than in our first restaurants, because in our first restaurants, we had the Italian-American chef and cuisine. But in Philidia, I started to cook the regional food of Italy. And that's the food that my grandmother cooked and that we cooked at home. Now, you know, Italy has 20 regions, so it's quite diverse, the cuisine. And that's what made a difference in what I was cooking and how people began to talk about me. You know, this woman chef, Italian woman chef, cooking this different Italian food. It brought in the journalist and a lot of attention.
And to you, did that feel like the pieces are fitting now? You know, I'm going back to where I'm comfortable. I know where this food comes from. I know how it should taste. And this is me.
I don't think I ever kind of say, okay, this is it. I was just challenged by the whole thing. I was challenged that I was capable of kind of taking that little recipe that I made with my grandmother and feed it to 50, 60 people. And I became like a conduit of my traditional culture, original culture, to my adoptive culture. And that gave me a lot of pleasure. It still does.
Our guest this hour is Lydia Bastianich. Her memoir is called My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Lydia Bastianich. Her memoir is called My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. So Lydia, we have some patient people. We're going to go to the phones now, and we'll speak first with Chris in Fort Worth. Chris, go ahead with your question.
Hi there. Such a pleasure to speak with you. It's always fun to hear about success stories and how people overcome the external things in their lives, but I'm interested to hear about maybe some internal or personal, maybe some hang-ups or failures that you overcame to be a success and to continue that.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. Yeah, life is kind of a roller coaster. You go up and you go down. And I think, the question is often a lot of times, how do you really get back on your feet and go, and it happens. So my child had a problem with his hip, and he was immobile in braces for 2 years. Then the restaurant opened, and the problems, the financial of having, we had to borrow from Graham for, because, you know, everything goes always over budget. So finally we opened, and then, you know, the actual kind of getting into the hard work of getting into the restaurants and so on. I mean, along the way, if you will, you know, this, we were blackmailed by a worker, I guess, who was a gambler, needed money, and there were the sort of the fact that they were going to kidnap our kids. You know, these things come along like just anybody's life, and you just have to kind of, I guess, approach it in head on, and address the issue, and either you overcome it or you kind of cut it out. That's not the road, or that's not the place, or you know, you live with that whatever dent it left in your lives. It continues. You know, I think the challenge is just of living life. I think in one of my biggest now emotional, you know, one would say, you're such a, you know, so you're in a comfort zone, you have beautiful children, grandchildren. And it is, you know, the thought, my mother is 97, she lives with me. And just the thought, when is that day going to come when I'm not going to have her anymore? And I really get emotional. So I guess all the sentiments that a human being has are normal.
Let's hear now from Donna in Frisco. Donna, you can go ahead with your question.
Thank you so much, Courtney. And Lydia, my question is, I have someone close to me who is an immigrant. She's Spanish-speaking. I'm trying to get her, to motivate her to learn English. She works long hours, as does her husband. They are the working poor. She says she doesn't have time. What can I do to help her, encourage her to learn English?
Yeah, that's, how old is she?
She just had her second baby.
I was just talking about, you know, my parents and especially my father. And sometimes it becomes more difficult in age to really face the learning of a new language. And maybe they think at that age that maybe you're taking away your identity, that you really want to be that person. So you just have to continue to encourage her and talk to her in English. Give her opportunities. Does she work for you?
Who is an immigrant?
Donna, can you hear me? Okay. We may not be able to hear the end of that question. Sometimes with the interference, it's hard. So you really think it's about providing opportunities for people?
I think
people,
providing opportunities, encouraging them, maybe giving them, you know, taking care of their children so that they have a time to go to a local school, a local gathering. And I think that you'd be doing her also a favor to give her some time on her own as a space. Sometimes the mothers, and especially I think Italian mothers too, they think that they are really committed to their children, their family, that, and it's not about them. Well, they have to kind of, you have to make them feel that it's about them. When they feel good, then their children and their family will feel better.
So you certainly had a lot of successes in your life, as we talked about. You have cookbooks out, you have this memoir, you have wildly popular markets, restaurants, cooking shows on television. When did it kind of sink in for you and Felice that this has worked, this is our life, and it's just getting better and better each day?
You know, I get that question. Okay, Lydia, now that you have reached, what do you think? You know, I don't see it that way. I see it as a continuum. It's, you know, it's always the evolving into something new. It is, I'm always learning. In my case, my children came into the industry back, and it's, you know, seeing them flourish and grow and being part of mentoring them. So it's a continuum. It's not, you know, you made a career, you stop, and, you know, you this is it.
So I want to play one other clip now. This one's actually from a lecture at Harvard, and it's part of their Science of Cooking series.
We chose to make risotto today and risotto is all about the technique. But, you know, as she said, they told me, well, you could cook, you can talk about it, you can make tastings. And I says, how am I going to have all these people look at me and not give them a tasting? So we have the two of them, which they're mixing a pot, so there'll be a tasting for everybody, because I think... because I think, you know, yes, you listen to the technique and to the whys and to the hows and answer the questions. But at some point, you know, you got to record it. You got to record the flavor, the textures, and all of that. So we made sure that you had that.
So I picked this clip because it seems like no matter what you're doing, you want to make sure there's some joy mixed in and some experience. Is that really tied together for you, that you can't just tell someone the theory, you got to share the food?
Absolutely. The food is the connector. I mean, you know, the food is the ultimate equalizer, if you will. It brings us all on the same plane. But specifically, if you're trying to transmit or teach, and especially in this case, where young people, young university students, they might have never had a risotto. How can I be there and cook and be known as this Italian chef and they do not taste me? Because when they taste that risotto, they will have tasted Lydia in a sense, and I will always be with them in their memory, in their flavor memory. So I wanted to go with the whole audience. I wanted to kind of be part of their memory.
So I was talking to one of my colleagues about this. It seems like all of America is obsessed with cooking, but maybe that just might mean being a spectator of cooking. I know I don't cook very much, but I am riveted by some of the cooking shows on television. Why do you think it is that we love to watch people make food? What is it about that that just gets us?
Well, because food is at the basis of life. Food is nurturing ourselves. Without food, we wouldn't be alive. And I think that a lot of time, you know, we have put so many priorities before food. And now what we're realizing, that sitting at the table with that food, nurturing your family, your friends or something, gives you that connection that nothing else gives. You know, when I cook, and, you know, and I cooked for many people, but I cooked for the two popes, Pope mm-hmm. Benedict and Pope Francis, when they were here. And you know, first I got this apprehension. Oh, my God, I'm going to cook with her. Then I just got in the kitchen. I did my thing, and I cooked. And I felt so comfortable, first with one, with the other. Food is the great equalizer. Everybody kind of comes down to intake of food, and all these kind of, I would say, antagonistic or whatever, they're all away because food is positive.
So if somebody comes to you and they kind of throw up their hands and they say, I can't cook, I'm just hopeless, what do you tell them?
I said, everybody can cook. Everybody can cook something. Everybody has handled food. You just have to take your time. You have to focus. And yes, some have more talent to do things than others. Some have more sensibility, more whatever you want to experience or whatever. But everybody can cook something. And what I say is just take the time, the patience. You get such a beautiful result out of cooking, of making food, of giving food, sharing food, that it's worth the concentration. So concentration, common sense, feel confident, and go ahead. The first time will be so-so, the second time will be better, and so on. It'll be better and better.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. So a question I've wondered about is, do you tell people who are maybe starting out cooking or are novices or want to get better, should they look to their family? Should they look to an aunt or a grandmother or a parent that's known for cooking, or find a recipe that somehow connects them to someone they know and love and are comfortable with? Is that a good way to get started?
I think that's a great way to get started, because most likely that's, you know, in growing up, those are the first experiences in cooking, in the kitchen, in the smell. You know, as newborns, we recognize our mother by the smell. So the power of our senses in taking in information, you know, it's enormous. So cooking in a house, even if the child is small, whether you cook Brussels sprouts that stink or broccoli that stink, the child smells those and associates them with a sense of comfort. That's home, even though it smells. And when they grow up, they'll eat it. So absolutely, if you're a chef, you start at home at the home base. And the food of your home is your profile. It's a profile. It tells you about you, your culture, where you come from, you know, what your beliefs are, even to some extent the religion, because religion guides how we cook, when we cook, and what. So look at that. That's first. That gives you a great base. And then you go and explore the world for other flavors and tastes.
So what's the one dish that you make now that most reminds you of your childhood?
The one that reminds me enormously of Sunday with Nonna Rosa was gnocchi with a chicken sauce. And I mean, the chicken, you know, those free-range chickens, those stuffed chickens, Grandma cooked them for 3 hours. But Saturday, she would kind of twist the neck and then we would pluck the chicken and get it ready and whatever. And then Sunday, I would help her make the gnocchi and the guazzetto, as we called it, the sauce, would be perking. And this aroma from early in the morning, you know, the whole courtyard smelled. And it was Sunday. And, you know, we all sat around the table. And sometimes there wasn't even space for everybody around the table. You know, the kids would sit on steps or whatever. But, you know, that flavor, that aroma kind of brings such great comfort and memories to me.
Tell me a little bit about when you first came to America. You obviously have good taste in food. You have a wonderful culinary palate. But there were some really American 1950s and 60s foods that maybe aren't super refined, but they just delighted you and your brother. Run through some of those for us.
Well, you know, some of the things that we love. First of all, Spam. You know, I mean, that was great. That Spam was delicious. Meat, you know, meat was scarce. And to be able to get this flavorful meat, that was very good. We liked that. Peanut butter and jelly. Peanut butter, we didn't have much. We had jams. But the peanut butter specifically with grape jelly on white bread, you know, that the whole thing kind of squished into something. We loved that. Then Twinkies, cupcakes, those chocolate cupcakes with the white stuffing in there. I mean, you know, all of those, I think, you know, we loved them. We enjoyed them. You know, even the experience of frozen foods, frozen dinners and all of that. And as I said before, you know, these instant packages of making cupcakes, of making regular cakes. I used to have a blast with those.
And one of your very first days in New York, you and your brother saw some Jell-O at the Automat, I think. And I mean, you didn't even know what that could possibly be.
We didn't know. You know, there is gelatin in Italian, of course, culinary repertoire, but that was kind of a meat gelatin and whatever. And here you had this wobbly red stuff and green stuff, this bright red, bright green. And, you know, we didn't know what was it. It was moving. We thought it was a fish or something. And yeah, we experienced those at the Automat. Well, some of the first desserts we had.
What do you think you learned about yourself when you were writing your memoir? I mean, obviously, it's your life. You've lived it. Looking back and kind of putting it all together, did you discover anything?
I think I did. And I did. And I think that as you move on in life, things that kind of are difficult and hard on you, you kind of hide them so they don't hurt you. But in this effort, even in all these experiences behind me, I pushed myself to bring them out, to bring the emotions that I felt at that time. And, you know, I kind of looked at myself, you know, and what it does to me, it brings me to seeing those young immigrants today and how they must feel. Do they feel what I felt there? So I think the emotions and the feelings and how one sort of protects oneself by hiding them, but at some point they have to come out.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Thank you so much, Lydia, author of My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. It's been such an interesting conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.